Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all. A lot to talk about today. Maybe I should talk less. We'll see. I'll skip a lot of stuff. But this week's parsha is a fascinating one, of course. They all are in their own way. This is Mishpatim. The word Mishpat we'll deal with in a second and then try to get it how we're working into our practice. Mishpatim in the definition of this parsha is ordinances or sometimes called laws. They're not really laws, but they're a follow-up to the revelation at Sinai. And it's Mishpatim are considered the ordinances that you would arrive at through your own sensibility and your own awareness of the way things should be in society. So a Mishpat comes to reinforce positive things that you wish to make eternal. This parsha particularly is kind of interesting because it has 53 mitzvot in it, which is quite a few, and there are many of them are mishpatim, or laws that still are viable today. And it's really about codifying the realities, the relationships, the behaviors of human life. And as you know, I've always been teaching this, is that, as you all know, law follows life. Life does not follow law. So if you look at the mitzvot, and there are quite a few, I don't want to go into all of them, but they deal with the social relationships, the creating of society, civil and criminal laws, social justice, monetary laws, interpersonal conduct, you know, returning lost property, helping an overburdened animal, not accepting bribes, prohibiting gossip, not charging interest. There's a major prohibition against oppressing or cheating strangers, widows, and orphans, and has to deal with damages for property, penalties for theft, quite a few. And they're a miscellany in a way. There's no real necessarily an inner logic to them. There's also some ritual laws as well. The other ones are not ritual, they're more societal laws. For instance, the cooking or eating milk and meat, Shemitah, the seventh year, the Sabbath, the three pilgrimage festivals, which are ritual rather than, if you will, societal. So why all these laws? Well, one of the things that law does, as I said earlier, is create something that is liberating. So for instance, in the way we understand it in rabbinic tradition, is that a mitzvot or halakha, which later it will become called halakha, the path, are considered a framework for a liberation, transforming divine engraved laws. Very interesting little midrash. The 10 sayings are engraved, harut in Hebrew, harut. They're written in stone. However, we have to transform that place of being written in stone into a place of chayrut. They play with the word, which without the vowels are written the same way. And chayrut means freedom. So freedom means you elevate life above instinct. And rather than restrictive, these Torah laws are viewed as tools to free individuals from all of the kinds of oppression and desires, etc. So the Torah acts as a guide. There's about a spiritual and personal growth in these mitzvot, ethical and social justice, looking for holiness, for purpose, and perhaps more important, collective connection, shared values, and freeing people from selfishness and isolation. So again, from the stone that is engraved, we get the mitzvot that are setting us free. And we won't go into involved in all of them, but I just wanted to just deal with this issue that somehow we have a hesitancy to see law as somehow restrictive rather than opening ourselves up to greater possibilities. And of course, in our own legal structure, there are things that we've made laws in order to preserve a life, and many of those things are very important for us. So that's fine. And on the surface, we could spend a lot of time on each law, but that's not really where I wanted to bring us. I want to bring us to how this can somehow help us with practice of a certain degree. So I wanted to go to the Zohar, which is our mystical interpretation, or our, how should I say, my esoteric, that's the word, esoteric interpretation of the Parsha. The Zohar, as you know, is probably written in the end of the 13th, 14th century in Spain. It, quote unquote, it's a pseudepigrapha book. It means it uses a pseudonym in the book for the author, and the pseudonym is that of Shimon Bar Yochai, a great student, and the Zohar is attributed to him, who lived in the 2nd century CE. So the book is a sort of it's a fascinating book, and very hard to read and to study without a mentor. But we've been blessed over the last 25 years to have a good friend of mine, Daniel Matt, a great scholar, translate the entire Zohar. It's called the Pritzker edition, put out by Stanford University, and now it's available in a very erudite translation. Doesn't mean it's easier, but he does offer footnotes, and he offers all ways of trying to understand the text. So I wouldn't read it as a book. It's not something you read as a book, even though there are some scholars who see it as a proto-novel, in a way, a proto-novel that uses these characters of Shimon Bar Yochai and his entourage traveling through ancient Palestine as a sort of a novelistic approach. But basically, all of these laws, particularly laws, for instance, about indentured servants, right? People who owe you money, they come to work for you. They're supposed to work 6 years and must go free on the seventh, and all kinds of mitigations of slavery. Yes, there is slavery, the term Eved, but they're either Eved Ivri, meaning a Hebrew slave who's an indentured servant, or you have non-Jewish slaves, and they are protected in many, many, many ways. They become part of your household. You're not permitted to cause any physical harm, etc. And there's all kinds of restrictions. But of course, it's still there, and we are, you know, often bothered by that. But the bottom line is, in the world that these things were written, this was definitely seen as something quite progressive. So the laws, of course, of responsibility for each other, treating strangers, orphans, widows, not to take interest, all of those things basically have a sort of a very deep spiritual source. And the idea is that every individual is in the image of God, if you will. So every individual has the certain kind of inherent dignity, and that's very important for this parsha, that each individual has the dignity. However, that dignity is often expressed within the collective. So we get that interesting and wonderful tension between the individual and the community, and how basically they interact with each other and help each other. Now, the Zohar, which offers, quote unquote, esoteric, that's a good word. I'd rather use esoteric than mystical. But this esoteric interpretation really has been very important to create a historical approach to Torah. The question is not whether these things actually happened, when it happened, and do these characters really exist. It's where the Zohar sees the civil laws that are outlined in Mishpatim as more than social and societal regulations, and they see them as expressions of divine justice that mirror the order of the spiritual realms of the Sefirot. So the laws governing interpersonal relationships, such as concerning theft or injury or property, are understood as physical manifestations of higher spiritual truths. So the Zohar, for instance, in chapter 2, says the laws of Mishpatim are the earthly reflection of the divine order that governs the upper worlds. Each law corresponds to a specific spiritual principle, ensuring that justice and balance are maintained both above and below. And when these laws are observed, they create harmony within the community and align the people with the divine will, allowing the flow of divine energy to continue unimpeded. Just a little note about the spiritual understanding of the upper and lower worlds is that we from below, okay, create a sort of hit orerut, it's called awakening, that our actions below cause a certain kind of energy to float into the upper worlds, allowing for the system of flow of the shefa, of the overwhelming, if you will, flow of the divine to operate. So it's really a dynamic system. It's a circle. We give power to the system through our observance of the mitzvot, and thus there is a reciprocal thing of the flow coming down and becoming the Shekhinah, that divine presence which dwells within us. So this interpretation, if you go further with it, you can basically go to each one and see how it reflects itself not only in our world but also in the cosmos, if you will. So if I could use a term, there is cosmic reverberation for all of our actions here. Cosmic reverberation. It sounds like a name from a good rock group, but that's what it is. So, for instance, if you go to the Mishpatim about the Hebrew slave, the Eved Ivri, or the Hebrew manservant or maidservant, so the Hebrew slave, it says in the Zohar, is a metaphor for the soul, which is temporarily bound to the physical world, serving the needs of the body. And the 6 years of service represent the 6 days of creation, during which the soul is engaged in material pursuits, and the seventh year, the year of release, symbolizes the Sabbath, a time of spiritual rest and liberation when the soul returns to its divine source. Very much talked about when it talks about the Sabbath, of course, the Shabbat, and its connection with the upper worlds. In our Friday night service, we often invoke the Zohar, talking about how observing the Shabbat frees the universe, if you will, the cosmos, from judgment and from ill feelings, and thus allows the Shabbat spirit to flow into us. And then we have a quote-unquote extra soul or on Shabbat. There's another mitzvah, mishpat, in the parsha, which you are very well aware of, which is the well-known idea of an eye for an eye. And of course, the rabbis, as well as the medieval mystics, tried to explain to us that this basically doesn't literally mean an eye for an eye, which doesn't help anybody, creates two blind people, but it's making sure that retribution or recompense or compensation for damages should be equal. So if a person has a limb injured, the compensation would be for what it costs, what the financial compensation would be for an arm. An eye would be different, and they're basically, it's a very important part of Talmudic interpretation, is to get away from the eye for an eye as a literal idea. In the Zohar, it's a principle of divine justice that operates to the concept of measure for measure. In Hebrew, it's called midah keneged midah. And this principle reflects the idea that one's actions directly influence the spiritual and physical consequences. So the Zohar says, and I'll be soon finished, but the Zohar says, the law of an eye for an eye is not to be understood literally, but as a representation of the divine principle of measure for measure. Just as one's actions create specific effects in the world, so do they create corresponding spiritual repercussions. And this law teaches that every action has a precise and just consequence, ensuring that divine justice is perfectly balanced. For instance, there's another very important principle in this parasha, which is, of course, against oppressing the stranger, the orphan, or the widow. And thus it says in the Zohar, the commandment not to oppress the stranger, orphan, or widow is rooted in the divine attribute of chesed, loving kindness. And just as God extends God's compassion to all, so too must God's people act with kindness and justice towards the vulnerable. And this law teaches that the measure of one's righteousness is found in how they treat those who are most in need and care of protection. There's also, of course, in the parasha, a new covenantal, if you will, reinforcement to the event at Sinai, and Moshe then will ascend again to get the second tablets. First ones, if you recall, were shattered because of the golden calf incident a while back. And Moses will go back up, and he will try to, and of course for the Zohar, anytime Moses ascends, it means he's going into some sort of soul journey, some mystical state, perhaps a deep meditative state that allows him to rise into the ether, if you will. So the Zohar tells us the covenant of Sinai was not just a legal agreement, but a spiritual union between Israel and the divine. When the people accepted the laws, they ascended spiritually, becoming a nation bound by the divine will. And Moshe's ascent into the cloud symbolizes the soul's journey into the unknown depths of divine wisdom, where the mysteries of creation are revealed. You may recall that before the giving of the Torah, back in Parshat Yitro last week, there was a sort of a conditionality. You will receive this covenant if you agree to become a kingdom of priests, it's, the term is used, Mamlechet Kohanim, and a Goy Kadosh, and a holy nation. So there is a duty that one takes upon oneself before entering into the covenant, and that is to create a moral society, which cannot be created from the outside, you understand? It has to be from within the society. So there are many different, of course, mystical, I won't go into all of them, the Arizal, for instance, Rabbi Luria, connects this, of course, with the process of Tikkun. Rabbi Cordovero, a teacher, also sees this laws as trying to balance between Chesed and Gevura, because real justice does have to have both mercy and justice entailed in it. Rabbi Ashlag, a more contemporary mystic, sees it psychologically, suggesting that laws represent the inner dynamics of the soul's relationship with God and with others. And, of course, the mitzvot are a guide, and I think this is what we can work with, is a guide for overcoming ego and for cultivating spiritual virtues, humility, compassion, and justice. So the covenant at Sinai is seen as the soul's commitment to living according to these principles, leading to spiritual growth and to fulfillment. So let me just conclude by saying the Zohar interprets all of these things as metaphors of how the material world affects not only ourselves as people, as you know, people of action, but also affects our spiritual transformation. So it's really important to realize that what we're looking for in this just society is, as I said earlier, a balance between Chesed and Gevura, and that's true justice. And remember, when we will later talk about Shoftim, about what are the qualities of judges, it becomes clear that they really have a tremendous amount of power to take each individual situation and judge it and try to create that balance between the law and the individual case. So rabbis, traditional rabbis, who would serve as judges as well, had an obligation to take the circumstances of each individual into account giving a legal decision. So I'm going to stop now because there's a lot more I can say about law and about all that kind of stuff. But what is important to me is basically is that it's really what we have here is something that we talk about all the time. How do you bring your spiritual life and your life of action into sync? That one is that what you're doing really can have an overall effect, and that there is it's important to not see ourselves apart from the law, but with a part of the law, in the sense that we are part of the process that creates law. And as I said earlier, in our tradition, law is something that liberates us and does not enslave us. So opening for a conversation, anyone who would like to make a comment, you may want to digest it a little bit, as I will, because I forgot what I said a moment ago. I have to go back in my head. What did I say? But it's